Okay, any preliminary questions to deal with? I'll be going upstairs to get the outlines to hand out to you during the break, so. Okay, well, we are finishing up Chapter 10 today and moving on to Chapter 11. And as I said, I wanted to spend a few minutes on this statute, the Washington statute, not because that's sort of the golden thread for the way other jurisdictions handle these questions, but I guess part of the ongoing theme of the way in which legislation interacts with court decisions. So lots of the law of torts is made up from court decisions, but a lot of it is affected by statutory enactments that modify or sometimes simply restate general principles. The first thing that's in the statute is a statute of limitations, actually, a special statute of limitations applying to health care providers. And you'll notice, that, again, it's this kind of compromise blend of different principles or different interests. They're actually three different periods that the statute talks about. The first is the idea that an action is timely if it is within 3 years of the time the procedure was done. So if you're within 3 years of the time the procedure was done, you're within the statute of limitations. There's another way to qualify within the statute of limitations, and that is if you file your claim within a year of the time you discovered or reasonably should have discovered the harm and its cause. So there is a discovery rule that says, to the extent it's some kind of hidden, unknown thing, you only discovered later that the doctor committed some kind of malpractice, you're not barred because it happens to be more than 3 years, so long as within 1 year of discovery you file your claim. But there's an 8-year outside statute of limitations that says you have to file it in any event, even if it's within 1 year of discovery. It's not timely unless it's filed within 8 years of the procedure. Again, trying to balance the interest of the healthcare provider with the interest of the patient, you have the provision that the defendant can assume 8 years after procedures have been done, no medical malpractice action would be timely. Except, there's yet another, exception to that, which is for various kinds of situations that would toll the statute of limitations, one being a foreign body left in a surgical procedure. It occasionally does happen. You hear about these things that, what was it the other day? Somebody left a screwdriver inside the patient.
They used the screwdriver as, they were supposed to have a rod that they were out of. So they found a screwdriver
right.
And put that in.
Yeah, so again, I would assume the patient would say, I consider the screwdriver a foreign body that didn't belong in my system. So there's also a tolling for fraudulent concealment. So that to the extent that the healthcare provider fraudulently conceals from you your medical malpractice claim, that prevents the statute of limitations from running. So again, you can see the way in which the legislature tried to accommodate circumstances. It also says, but if the court decided not to pay any attention to, the provision that the knowledge of the parent is imputed to a child. So unlike the tolling that prevents the statute of limitations from running until a child becomes an adult, we looked at this back in Chapter 7, here the legislature apparently said that we want the statute of limitations to run on, or at least to, we want the statute of limitations to move along, that is, not to be told, where the parent has knowledge of something done to a child. It turns out the courts looked at this and said, well, we don't think the legislature intended for this to supersede the provisions elsewhere in the statute on tolling, which I found kind of extraordinary. Why did the legislature put this in there if they didn't intend such a thing? But whatever. So, again, ways of trying to accommodate the interests of the patients at the same time protect health care providers from a sort of interminable statute. Okay, the statute also has provisions for stating what the three basic types of health care claims are, so that we've talked about the difference between a claim for, essentially, for professional negligence, for a failure to meet the standard of care for this kind of procedure. We've also talked about informed consent. There's a third basis for liability in here, which is essentially breach of an express warranty. That is, if the healthcare provider promises a specific outcome, like the guy at Men's Warehouse, I guarantee it. If the physician says not, hey, I'll do the best I can, this thing usually turns out well, but I promise you this is the way your nose will look just like this when I'm done with the surgery. Well, in that case, again, the patient can make a claim for that, but that's not a very typical situation. Okay, then the statute, as I recall, talks about how you make these claims. That is, how do you establish the breach of the standard of care, and you do it by comparing what the healthcare provider did to a healthcare provider in the state of Washington in the same or similar circumstances. The point being that the expert you use to establish negligence has to be familiar with the practice of medicine in the state of Washington. Doesn't mean they have to be a resident of the state of Washington, but you've got to find somebody who says, I'm familiar with the way obstetrics is practiced in the state of Washington, or the way emergency room medicine is practiced, whether they've practiced here, they teach here, they consult here, however it is they acquire that knowledge. That's enough for them to be able to testify. You can't simply bring somebody in from Alabama and say, well, I know how emergency room medicine is practiced in Alabama. Some states have a nationwide standard where you can do that. But here it's somebody who's in the state of Washington. And, again, it is adapted to what the circumstances are. So that if someone is only familiar with the way you practice medicine in a big city hospital with all kinds of equipment and lots of frequent consultations with other doctors where you can easily refer people to specialists, that's a different kind of medicine from what the kind of medicine you're practicing in Republic, Washington, or in Othello, or in some place where the doctor is expected to do a wide range of things and doesn't have the luxury of specializing or frequently consulting with other physicians. Then they have a long section on informed consent, and the concept behind, again, informed consent is that you explain the both the material risks, and you explain alternative therapies to the patient before you secure consent. The statute also encourages people to, encourages healthcare providers to use a written consent form, although it doesn't make it mandatory. I was recently in the emergency room with my 13-year-old who had a fairly deep cut on his finger, and so, you know, they spent an hour and a half waiting for somebody to take a look at it. When they finally did, you know, figured out what was going on and then wanted to sew it up, and just before they did that, they handed me a clipboard with a form on it and said, "We need your signature here." Well, that was informed consent. That sort of thing is in one sense helpful, but could get the practitioner into trouble to the extent that it becomes so routinized that there's really not much of an opportunity to actually explain what's going on, let the person ask questions, what are the alternatives, are you sure this is the right thing to do? Well, you know, if the physician's assistant in the emergency room is about to stitch up my son's finger, and he's got to inject some local anesthetics so that he can work on it without my son yelping in pain. As long as we don't think there's any problem, you know, he's not allergic to these medications so far as we know. It's this pretty, you know, easy thing. I think I mentioned before my daughter had some work done on her teeth, and the dentist wanted to do it under general anesthesia. And when I went to the, I got a, you know, phone message or somehow they said, "We'd like you to come down and sign the form." So I, you know, find the dentist's office and go up to the receptionist, say, "Hi, I'm Robin DeWolf's father, and I'm supposed to be signing some consent form." So she hands me this clipboard again with this form on it, and as you'll see from the statutory language, it gives you two alternatives. One, I've been informed of the risks and I consent to the procedure, or there's an alternative thing, which is I don't want to know. I know there are risks out there, but I just assume not be told about all these risks. So on this clipboard, both boxes were checked. So the question in my mind was, first of all, do I make an issue out of this? And, of course, I couldn't help myself. I had to make an issue out of it. So I said, you know, I don't want to be difficult, but, you know, I'm happy to sign this first one. But it seems like the second one is contradictory. You know, the first one says, I've heard about the risks and I consent. The second one says, I don't want to hear about the risks. Can I just sign the first one here? She looks up at me with that look of, what rock did you crawl out from under? I said, okay, I'll just sign them both, you know. So, again, the encouragement, the statute encourages doctors to use, or, you know, healthcare providers to use forms, written forms, rather than simply relying on an explanation to the patient, which is much more likely to get lost in the fog of time. If something goes wrong with this procedure and suddenly you're trying to recollect, well, gee, the 14th patient that I saw that day, I vaguely remember doing sewing up this finger, or, you know, treating somebody's scraped knee or dealing with an ear infection. I'm sure I must have told them about, you know, asking them if they were allergic to these medicines and explaining to them that there are other ways of trying. Do I remember that person specifically? No. The advantage of having a form is that it suggests you've actually gone through that process. But, of course, in reality, it's just a formality. I put my signature on that form, but I don't remember much about that. Again, my advice, for what it's worth, and this applies to lawyers as much as it does to doctors, at every opportunity to put things in writing that document your communication with your client. This might look like you're simply covering your rear end, sort of practicing defensive medicine or practicing defensive lawyering, but it's often very helpful, as you know, from writing case briefs, or you know, from, you know, doing things where, gee, when I start to write it down, I find ambiguities that I thought were clear in my head, but until I wrote them down, I didn't quite work out all the details. So when you write stuff down and you know, make a record of it, I think you wind up doing better work than when you simply trust that, oh yeah, I'm sure that was okay, we made a deal, or, you know, I must have explained that to them. I don't know why she misunderstood me on that point, because I always tell them about that. Well, that's not the way she remembers it. Oh, well, then we may have a problem here. Okay, Mr. Gallagher.
What's your take on a situation where you have an adult in the hospital, a parent is present, and the parent is approached to sign a consent form for the administration of a particular drug, but at that time, the adult patient is lucid, awake,
right? Well, that's the segue into the next part of this informed consent statute, which says, here's sort of the chain of command. Our preference is to get the consent from the patient, but if the patient is unavailable, you know, not capable of giving that consent, you may obtain this consent. Well, first of all, you can obtain it in an emergency situation by implying it. You know, somebody's been in an auto accident, and you're the paramedic that's trying to, you know, rescue them, you simply imply their consent that they would want something done for them when I don't have time to explain. If I sat there and tried to explain to this, person who's groaning in pain, well, gee, I have this pain medication, it does have certain side effects. In a limited number of cases, there are blah, blah, you know, whack, I'm going to do this thing and get the show on the road. So again, first of all, in an emergency situation, you have the authorization where consent is implied. But if it's not an emergency, you have this, like the, you know, if the president dies, the vice president takes over, and then the speaker of the house, and you have a whole chain of who you go to if the person next in line is unavailable. And it's often a judgment call as to whether or not this person is the right, you know, should this person be giving consent as opposed to somebody else. And, you know, my advice to the physician or the healthcare practitioner is, you know, talk to as many people as you can. That is, that unless there's some sort of confidentiality issue where, gee, this is something, and in fact, there's a recent Medical Privacy Act, which the physicians are now complaining about because it's very difficult under this Medical Privacy Act to, you know, talk to somebody about somebody else's medical condition. So, you know, you're the doctor and you're calling up to see, well, how's, you know, we did something for your wife, and how's she doing with this, you know, different dosage of medication, or did that little thing turn out okay? Well, gee, they can't even talk to me about that, you know, unless she signed some specific authorization. Again, this whole question about, obviously there are certain circumstances in which you wouldn't want the physician calling up the parent and saying, well, gee, I just saw your daughter, you can understand that situation, but again, sort of a rule of common sense. My advice to the physician would be, within, except for this stupid medical privacy bureaucracy, talk to as many people as you can. Try to explain to them. You know, oftentimes you have an adult who's in the hospital. They may be lucid in the sense they're not unconscious, but it's sometimes easier to talk to a family member who's not in as much pain or someone who's actually in a position to sort of help them make a decision. It's not that you wouldn't explain it to them, and I would prefer to get the signature from the person who actually is going to undergo the procedure. But again, you may get the signature from this other person, but at the same time, explain it to the patient orally. And again, it's just sort of a common sense judgment that I think, and again, oftentimes people get so busy actually doing the thing they think is so valuable, they don't bother to explain it to people. This is the idea of having a good bedside manner. You refer to a physician, you know, some physicians have a reputation of being really technically very highly skilled. They do great work, but they have a terrible bedside manner. They don't explain things very well. They're hard to get hold of. You know, they're not a real good communicator, but they do good work. And you have other people who are really charming and congenial and cordial. Their skills are so-so. And you know, same thing is true of lawyers. Exactly the same principle. And again, part of what you want to do is try to get the best of both worlds. You don't want to devote all your attention to being, warm and fuzzy. You want to devote a lot of your attention to being technically competent, but you also want to try as best you can to be communicative. As I said yesterday, this Jan Schlickman in Civil Action got into a lot of this trouble because he wasn't warm and fuzzy with his own clients, got so caught up in what he thought was, you know, this quixotic battle he was engaged in, that he forgot to sort of check back with his clients and say, here's where we are, here's how it's going. In any event, again, the statute tries to clarify these things, does provide, I think, it's better organized, it's sort of, you know, all in one place here, the principles are laid out. But there's still a lot of room at the edges here for figuring out what these different provisions mean. As I say, this is only kind of a sample of one jurisdiction. You, for purposes of the exam, would want to rely on more general principles about the standard of care, the importance of expert opinion, and then the principles of informed consent. Any questions about Chapter 10 before we motor on to our last chapter here? Yes? Right. I forget which is 020, I think it is, that lays out the nature of the claims. It's 030, actually. They're essentially a like the product liability statute, which tries to sort of unify these disparate bodies of law into a single kind of product liability claim. So this statute tries to clarify the three different types of claims. And again, one is negligent procedure. The second one is breach of warranty, which as far as I'm concerned, you can ignore for purposes of the exam because hardly ever happens. And third, you have a lack of informed consent. Mr. Jones.
You have other forms of medical malpractice.
Yes. Well, it's actually other forms of professional malpractice. Yeah, it's very, and again, I've made analogies to legal malpractice, something you all would be interested in. Principles, as I say, are often analogous. The idea about the standard of care, and then the idea about informed consent. When you turn down a settlement offer because you think the chances are better at trial, your judgment as to whether or not the claim would likely generate a substantial award if it were taken to trial, that may be a perfectly sound professional judgment, but you have to make sure that it's your client that's making that choice rather than you. In the end, your client decides to take $50,000 rather than take a chance of getting $250,000, but also taking a chance of getting nothing, which is preferable, obviously depends in many cases on your judgment about the likelihood that you would actually recover that larger amount, but it also depends upon the client's choice as to whether or not they're in a mood to gamble. And also, to a lesser extent, other kinds of professions, real estate brokers or architects or educators or clergy, there are special problems with clergy malpractice because of the reluctance of the courts to get enmeshed in doctrinal or religious issues. And it's actually a very difficult area because of the dual role that clergy often play, where clergy act as counselors as well as spiritual advisors. And as the case I cite, this Nally case, where after consulting with a pastor, this guy goes out and kills himself. And the allegation was that the pastor negligently counseled this guy. And the question arises, well, was that the exercise of his religious role, which is not subject to review by the courts, or was that the exercise of his counseling role, which is analogous to the kind of counseling that you would get from a psychologist or a psychiatrist, where you could apply some sort of general standard and hold people accountable. So that's an area. With respect to the, you know, all the sex abuse scandal, particularly in the Catholic Church, none of that poses any doctrinal or theoretical problems. That's clearly not covered by any kind of claim that, well, gee, this is part of our religious tradition. Whereas you could have claims where, for example, somebody practicing Christian Science could be alleged to have negligently handled somebody's medical fund. Again, there's interesting stuff there, but I'll simply have to sort of hint at that before we move on. Okay, Chapter 11. You may have the feeling that in many ways I've done things exactly backwards. If the traditional definition of a tort claim is, as we've seen before, duty, breach, causation, damage, I've saved, if not the best, at least I've saved the first for last, which is, well, how do you know that the defendant owed the plaintiff a duty? And up till now, I've sort of allowed you to take for granted that part of the question for this reason, that most of the cases we have looked at involve a situation where the defendant caused the plaintiff's harm. The defendant ran over the plaintiff. The defendant negligently performed some medical procedure. The defendant sold a product that harmed the plaintiff. The typical scenario is the defendant hurts the plaintiff. Now, obviously, the question is, were they subject to strict liability? Are they negligent? Did it actually cause the harm? What sort of harm did it cause, etc.? In Chapter 11, we take up the more difficult but very common case where the plaintiff is accusing the defendant not of doing something, but of failing to do something. And before we say your failure to do this caused the plaintiff's harm, And before we start asking, well, what would a reasonable person have done in those circumstances, we have to start with a more basic question of, when does a defendant owe the plaintiff a duty to prevent some kind of harm? Not the case where the defendant is taking a risk, and we ask whether or not the defendant can fairly be held liable for causing the plaintiff's harm, but here's a situation where the risk arose from some other source, and the defendant didn't enhance that risk or make it worse. The defendant simply failed to make it better. Does that give rise to a tort claim? And the answer, the reason we devote such time as we do to this question, is that the answer is neither yes nor no. The answer is, well, it all depends. To be sure, we start with the proposition that in the absence of some other factor or some other consideration, ordinarily you don't owe a duty to rescue or prevent harm. And the example is given in this first case, Book versus Amory, sort of classic example. You see some child endangered by some peril, the child sitting on the railroad tracks or the child face down in a puddle of water, where you could easily rescue this child, pull the child to safety. If you fail to do so, may society charge you with committing a tort? And the answer is no. And the explanation for this sort of anomaly is the difference between the morality of the act and the legality of the act. There is a wide gulf, says the court, between what is moral and what is legal. And you're entitled to ask, I would think, about the relationship between these two worlds, the world of what is moral and the world of what is legal. It's not as though they live in completely different areas, or they oftentimes we make things legal or illegal depending upon our belief about the morality of different kinds of acts and the consequences of those acts. How is it that something so morally wrong as walking by a child in peril and failing to help that child, how is it we could fail to make that illegal? What's the policy explanation for that? Or is it simply wrong that we ought to change it? We ought to conform the law to our moral intuition that someone who did this, someone who failed to do that, would be a person of terrible moral depravity. Yourselves?
Does that have to do with the relationship between the person in the puddle and the person walking by?
Well, let me just clarify the fact that I'm assuming there is no such relationship. If I pass my child face down, or I pass the person I'm babysitting, then it's a different story. But let's assume we're complete strangers to one another. The other Mr. Stubbs, yes?
Well, traditionally, don't legislators try to stay away? away with moral judgments when they're making laws. You know, they try to stay away from, okay, this is moral, so...
Well, in the civil rights movement, for example, lots of people said that, you know, whether you discriminate against people on the basis of race is a matter of, you know, personal morality, but the law, the expression, you can't legislate morality. And Martin Luther King responded, well, yes, but you can legislate the conditions under which people can be moral. And people said, okay, and enacted the civil rights laws. And again, you could say, well, that was a bad move, but you could also say, again, it's not a perfect relationship, but it's not as though the two worlds, it's not as though people never legislate about things that are moral, but it is a complicated relationship. Ms. Beard?
I was thinking that one of the ways that it would be justified is that in attempting to help someone in peril, you could actually cause them more harm.
Okay. Right. So in the example I gave back in Chapter 6 of the lady who gets hit by the roofing shingles and is pinned against her, you know, steering wheel, and everybody's afraid to move her for fear of doing more harm than good, but wouldn't that be covered under standard, again, of reasonable care? Just as we say when a wasp flies into your car, we're not expecting you to make perfect decisions. We're just saying you're accountable to the people on the jury as to whether you acted reasonably. So if the person passing the kid in the puddle says, well, maybe there's some good reason for this. Maybe he's learning how to swim. I don't know. You know, if the jury would find your behavior reasonable, just like, why do we treat this different from swatting a wasp? Ms. Jones? I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Okay, again, wouldn't this fall under the same standard of reasonableness? So, you know, if the little kid is in the gutter and I'm walking down and I can just pull the kid up and put him back on the sidewalk, whereas if the kid is in the surf, you know, and I'm so-so as a swimmer, I can reasonably say, we could have two dead people here instead of one dead person, and therefore it would be reasonable for me to call for help rather than throw myself into the same peril. But again, couldn't we cover that by saying, all we ask of you is to act reasonably? Why is it that society doesn't impose a duty on us to act reasonably to help someone in peril? Mr. Zarpris? Well, it's certainly a common reaction. I mean, this is, well, it may be 40 years ago, but there was a famous case of Kitty Genovese, who was attacked in an apartment in New York. It was actually a summer night in New York where everybody had their windows open, and she was attacked by a guy with a knife who stabs her, and she's seriously wounded, calling out for somebody to help her. And he initially runs away, but then nobody even picks up the phone to call the police. He comes back and finishes the job, and she's dead. And everybody's saying, what has happened here? And when they ask people, well, why didn't you just pick, I didn't want to get involved. And this was sort of a, my goodness, what sort of a society have we become? Legally speaking, however, those people can't be sued, they can't be held criminally liable, even though we would look at it and say, have you no decency, how could this be? Why would the law have such a crazy position?
There may be some limitless liability in the sense that what could be considered reasonable. I mean, for me to bag up my dinner and send it, you know, my leftovers, send it to China to stop world hunger, maybe that's reasonable. But that would be, you know, I mean, that's something that I don't do regularly, but maybe we should start to do that. So it seems like there could be this limitless.
This is sort of the slippery slope argument. If we require people to pull babies out of the gutter, Could we also require you, if the guy is saying, I need $5 to get to the emergency room, am I essentially, do I have to give this guy $5 to get a taxi to get to the hospital? If he says, my kids haven't had anything to eat for 2 days, you know, I need $5 to go to the grocery store. Could the government compel me to do all these other things? It was actually an argument against progressive taxation, that the government had no business taking my money to help somebody else out just because I'm rich and they're poor. You'll allow the camel's nose under the tent and will essentially authorize the government to put us all in the poorhouse. I think it is precisely this worry about a slippery slope that while we will authorize the government to prevent us from doing evil, we do not authorize the government to force us to do good. There are many things we might do, whether it's helping some homeless person, you know, will work for food, injured vet, whatever, with a cardboard sign at the freeway exit. Do I have a legal obligation to help that person? No, I don't. Again, the sort of reason for the refusal, I would say, to enact laws that would require people to help others in peril is, where would it lead? And I guess we hope that most people will act in a way that, even without legal pressure to do so, lots of people will not only pull that baby out of the gutter, will pick up the phone and call the police if someone's being stabbed outside their window. Lots of times in situations, we see people doing remarkably heroic things, not because they're legally required to do so, but because they do have a sense that they're what their moral duty is. So, again, the starting premise, as we had a starting premise in sovereign immunity, we have a starting premise here that you don't owe a duty to help somebody. But, of course, it's not quite that simple because sometimes you do owe a duty to help somebody. And that's what we have to identify. Despite our starting assumption, the default setting, as it were, that the failure to act is not a basis for legal liability, there are exceptions to that rule. And we start considering those exceptions in the Tarasov case. Like other California cases, Dillon versus Legg and others, this is sort of a household word in this area of law about the liability of people in the situation of the defendant. So can somebody tell us about Tarasov?
There was a man who was visiting a psychiatrist, describing him that he wanted to kill a particular individual. And
was that individual identified?
Yes.
Yes.
It was an identified individual. The doctor had contacted his couriers and the police, and they apprehended the patient.
They detained him, yes.
Yeah, they detained him. When the police, after speaking to him, reasoned that he was safe, that he wouldn't cause any harm, they let him go. And he went out and killed the person that he said he was going to kill.
Okay. And what are her parents, Titania's parents, then sue the university? It turns out it's the University of California. It's their counseling service where this, where the murderer expressed his intent. And so the parents of Titania sue the university, and what's their basis of their claim against the university?
They claim that the university had a duty to inform their daughter and to protect her because they knew of a specific threat against her.
Yes. And obviously, before you look at the details of this case, one of the arguments you might make on the university's behalf to say why the university shouldn't be held liable would be
patient-doctor relationship.
Okay. Yeah. And a variety of things connected with that. One being, well, how do I know as a physician when my patient, I mean, after all, in the course of counseling, you encourage people to express their feelings and you help them distinguish feelings from what they really want to do. You help them say, well, yeah, this is the way I feel, but of course I'm not going to act on that feeling, or it would be a bad idea. I'm really frustrated with my spouse. You know, there are all these tensions. I feel like, you know, just slamming the door and driving off, you know, like Jack Nicholson in Five Easy Pieces, just bailing out of the whole thing. But after I talk to my counselor, I feel a whole lot better, and I go back and become, because I really don't want to do that. It's just I feel so much pressure. So, so if I'm talking to my therapist, and I say to my therapist, you know, my girlfriend makes me so mad sometimes I just want to strangle her. The therapist has to identify, well, how much of this is feeling, which is, something I'm trained to help diffuse and get the person to be more thoughtful about it. And to what extent, when my patient says that, I pick up the phone and call the girlfriend and say, watch out for him because he's a real threat. So one argument is, gee, as a therapist, it's often difficult to make that kind of judgment. Why isn't that a good argument for the university in this case?
Foreseeability.
Well, there's an even stronger argument.
Why it's not good for the university?
Yeah. Why can't they claim, gee, when he said, I feel like I want to go out and kill my girlfriend, I thought he was just, you know, speaking metaphorically. Well, there's even more devastating information in this case for the university, Ms. Jones. Yeah, they call campus security and ask him to be detained. I mean, this is not something where they, you know, made a judgment that this was just a form of words. They knew this guy was close to doing this thing. There's another reason the university might give, even if they strongly suspected that this person was, in fact, cauldron of getting ready to burst. Why would a therapist hesitate to go warn the potential victims if the therapist suspects that bad things are going to happen? If you were a therapist, why would you hesitate to do that?
You don't want to unduly scare the victim.
Okay, you obviously have to worry about false positives as well as false negatives and, you know, sort of the statistical language. You want to find true positives and true negatives. True positives are the ones who fit the description. True negatives are the ones who don't fit the description. You can have false positives, people you think are going to do it who don't, and false negatives, people you don't think who do it who will. And there's obviously the risk of identifying too many false positives where you warn people and scare them and so forth. But there's another risk of picking up the phone and calling the potential victims. In addition to the fact that I might be wrong and be over-inclusive and have a bunch of false positives. Ms. Woodruff?
Well, I think that the person would quit coming to that particular person and sharing. It would be the end of that relationship.
That's right. The chilling effect upon the relationship itself. The reason this person comes to me in the first place is because they have the confidence that I will treat their information confidentially. If I go to the therapist and share with the therapist, gee, I'm having such difficulty at home, I'm thinking of getting in my car and just driving, you know, and getting away from all of this. I met this girl at the supermarket. She's, you know, if the therapist, you know, goes to tell, you know, who knows my wife socially, picks up the one, your husband, and let me tell you what your husband just told me. You know, I'm not going to share that information, and I'm not going to have the opportunity to work out the things. Similarly, we have the same arrangement with lawyers. The idea is that if I go to my lawyer and say to my lawyer, I've done this and I've done that, please defend me, the lawyer's not going to use that information to say to the judge, well, if my client were innocent, I'd be happy to defend him, but he told me this, this, and this, and I think you ought to throw him in the slammer. That's not the way the system works. If I tell my lawyer something, the lawyer has to keep it confidential. There's an extreme case of this that happened in New Hampshire about 20 years ago. I don't know how long ago it was. A guy sitting in his office in New Hampshire is a lawyer, and this guy makes an appointment, comes in, and explains to him that he's under suspicion in this town. There's a girl, 12-year-old girl, who disappeared, and people are pointing the finger at him and accusing him. And the lawyer says, well, why are they saying that? He says, well, as a matter of fact, I killed her. You what? I killed her. And he doesn't know whether this guy is, you know, well, how come they can't find her? He says, well, I put her body in a hollow tree. He did? He said, yeah, it's over, you know, on or off of Route 8, you know, blah. The lawyer's thinking, I don't know whether my client's hallucinating or whether this is real. The lawyer gets in his car, drives to this spot, looks in the hollow tree, there's the body. What's he to do? He gets back in his car and drives back to his office. When I asked this question the last time, you know, what's the lawyer to do? And one student facetiously said, double your hourly rate. Which I thought was well-timed. But what is the lawyer's obligation at that point? And worst of all, the lawyer believes that he cannot disclose the information, you know, he can't turn his client in, he can't move that body, he can't do anything. And he finally gets a phone call from the girl's mother. Hello, this is Mrs. So-and-so. I just have one question. Is my daughter alive or dead? Click. He can't answer her. Of course, that by itself may be, you know, but when eventually the evidence turns up, they find the body or he confesses, something resolves this and he's finally convicted, the New Hampshire Bar Association wants his head on a platter. And he defends himself by saying, I felt under the professional rules I had no choice. And eventually, The Supreme Court of New Hampshire agreed with him and withdrew the sanction that had been imposed or proposed by the Bar Association. Now that's, an extreme example. No one would ever want to be in that situation, but I would say, for what it's worth, that lawyer did exactly the right thing. Because if you don't honor the confidences of your client will mistrust you. Now, to be sure, you have an obligation to the system as a whole. In fact, there's a very interesting case in this. Recently decided, a guy named Doug Schaefer, lawyer in Washington, was in his office minding his own business, and a client comes in bragging about some sweet deal he got from the trustee of an estate who was going to sell him this piece of property and a real bargain price. And so the lawyer does the deal, not really paying any attention to what the guy's saying. Later on, he connects that the trustee who has given him this sweet deal is now a sitting judge. His name is Cadillac Anderson, so-called, because the lawyer, the client, later gave a Cadillac to this judge in exchange for the sweet deal that he had gotten. The judge was eventually thrown off the bench, removed for judicial misconduct, but the lawyer was hauled before the Bar Association. And Schaefer stubbornly refused to admit that he'd done anything wrong. I kind of agree with him, actually, but it's a very interesting case. Schaefer argues his own case to the Washington Supreme Court and says, in effect, my duty to the integrity of the judicial system was greater than the duty to my client. Yes, I disclosed what my client told me, but my client had just told me that he was, a judge sitting on the bench was a crook who traded, judicial favors, in effect, for campaign contributions. Now, he argued that his case fit into the exception to the rule, which is you can and should and must, in fact, disclose future criminality of your client. So if your client comes in and tells you, I murdered this girl and her body's in a hollow tree, that's something in the past, you can't disclose that. If your client says, I'm beating my wife, how much can I beat her and get away with it? What's the law on this point? Then you do have a duty to disclose ongoing criminality. And Schaefer's argument was, to the extent I knew of a judge on the bench as a result of past criminality, that gives me the right, indeed the obligation, to disclose what I know to remove him from the bench. He lost. They disbarred him. They suspended him from the practice of law for 6 months. So I thought it was a bit odd, that Schaefer, who put his own neck on the line to do what he thought was right in the system, who exercised independent ethical judgment, was told by the Bar Association, in effect, shut up and do what you're told. And be sorry about it, at least. Be contrite. Be penitent. He wasn't. Anyway, very interesting questions about the duties of lawyers. But, getting back to Tarasoff, Tarasoff says you had a duty to warn, and if the university tried to say, well, we didn't know he was serious. Of course you did. That's why you called campus police. Well, we were worried if we disclosed this information, it would poison the relationship. Well, yeah, campus security picks this guy up. He knows you've disclosed it. All the harm that you worry might have flowed from disclosing this information has already occurred. Why, in addition to calling campus security, didn't you at the same time call Titania? You knew her name. You could find, her and call her and say, please exercise extreme caution here. Your boyfriend is seriously, or I don't know if she considered him as her boyfriend, he's very disturbed. That could have saved her life. So, what's the court's decision here?
They actually ruled against the University of California.
And not ultimately on the merits, but to the extent that the university had argued, you can't pursue this case any further, you should dismiss it as a matter of law, cases like this don't fly, the court said, if the jury believes that you were acting unreasonably, they can impose liability. Now, what distinguishes this case from the other cases where you see someone in peril and you simply walk by?
The court said something like that. Okay.
That's a little bit of a chilling thing to say, well, yeah, we have our rules except when we really, really want them, you know, when we... unless you find a girl's body in a hollow tree, you know, that your duty to your client ends where the public, you know, outrage begins. And certainly if you were that lawyer, you learned the meaning of the oath that you took to hold the secrets of my client inviolate. Because they're going to want your head on a platter. And people who, you know, even intelligent people, not even intelligent people, but lots of people are going to say, you're a monster, mister, that you couldn't bring yourself to do the right thing. Again, he thought that's what he had agreed to do when he signed up to be a lawyer. Now, I think what the court winds up saying is that there is a special relationship in this case. What's the special relationship?
The special relationship between the doctor and the potential victim?
Yes. What is that special relationship? How is the doctor related to Tanya?
By a special relationship where obligation was created through society and public policy says you have a special relationship because of the system.
How would it have been different if Podar came in, expressed all of these psychopathic ideations, and is really in obvious, he's a, you know, Ted Bundy, whatever the guy's name, Robert, the mass serial killer, Robert Yates, you know, a guy like that, but never identifies this person by name.
There's no foreseeability.
And no relationship.
There's no relationship.
Yeah.
They have no,
it's because the university knows her name that the duty arises. And this is one of the things that often marks the difference between the liability of a police department or otherwise, where, for example, there are lots of these cases, alas, domestic violence, where typically the woman comes in, says, my ex-husband, my boyfriend, my still, you know, my estranged husband has threatened to kill me, you've got to provide me with protection. And the police say, well, we'll try to get to that, but, you know, we got a lot of other things to do. You know, call us if there's any trouble, and then she shows up in a pool of blood. Is the police department liable for failing to provide reasonable protection for her? And the first question is, was there a special relationship? Yes, they knew this particular victim, and she had begged them. Now, typically, the courts will say there's no liability even when they know about it unless they assure her and provide her with the sort of promise, don't worry, we'll keep an eye out for him. Don't worry, the sheriff's on his way now to, you know, whatever. Then the agency faces some liability. Yes.
How would you prove that? Would that have to be in writing somehow? Or would it be submitted with words that somebody
else? Sometimes you have the 911 tapes where the person calls in a panic and says, help, help, you know, He just called me on his cell phone. He said he's at the 7-Eleven. He's coming over to beat my brains out. And someone on the 911, we'll send somebody right away. That's on the 911 tape. In other cases, obviously, it's a he said, she said kind of testimonial conflict. But again, the legal question is, under what circumstances do you and I as taxpayers want to be held liable because the police department, the sheriff's office, the mental health department, child protective services, all these different agencies that are out there to protect us do a less than perfect job? In 2020 hindsight, we go back and say, gee, didn't you pick this up? You know, again, you go back to 9/11. Now we can see what should have been done, and the failure to do that resulted in all this horrible tragedy. Is it fair to blame those people and make them pay for it? Mr. Potter? In New Orleans?
they caught a wire tap with some of the circuit cops. They said one of the cops, I guess, talking about some lady who was reported in fatality or something on the brother. So apparently there was some conversation going on between the circuit cop and hit man. They were kind of trying to figure out what's going on.
Right. Yeah. Again, you have to understand this both from the plaintiff's standpoint and from the defendant's standpoint. That from the plaintiff's standpoint, you think, I rely on the police department, you know, mental health, child protective services. I pay my tax dollars for these people to provide protection. The one time when I really need them, they fail. And they may fail in really egregious ways. You know, where the cop's going off to buy his, you know, he's Chief Wiggum in The Simpsons, you know. He's going off to buy a donut while, you know, somebody's getting attacked. So, we understand the plaintiff's perspective. At the same time, you got to understand the defendant's perspective, which is, I run this multifaceted, it's like being the commander on the ground, General Franks or Rumsfeld, running the Iraqi war, where you have all these different fields of engagement, and you got to put resources here and put resources there. And yeah, in every circumstance, you'd love to be able to put all your resources over here, but you're trying to get the most bang for your buck. And occasionally you wind up, you know, you're waiting to catch this big fish sitting there listening to the wiretap, and along the way, oh yeah, somebody gets killed. Well, yeah, but if we went out for every criminal act that was being discussed over this wiretap, we'd never get the whole corrupt police system. That was what we were after, and we're entitled to sort of make these strategic trade-offs. Just as the police have to decide, I'm not going to go for every break-in, every call. You know, you watch cops on TV, and, you know, they go to all these domestic violence things where people are beating each other up and, you know, typically intoxicated or strung out on drugs. And, you know, they're trying to do something, but they sort of feel like they're walking into this ongoing soap opera. And they do what they can, and then they leave. Well, again, how do they distinguish those cases where their intervention is the difference between life and death and those where they're going to go put a Band-Aid on something and it's going to revert to its same-o the next time? So the defendants want to be cut some slack to make professional judgments rather than having the tort lawyers looking over their shoulder all the time, breathing down their neck, second-guessing every decision they make about law enforcement. The tort lawyers now are going to run law enforcement. That's not a very good state of affairs. That's what the defendants say. And again, it applies not just to the police department, to the counseling profession, to child protective services, to all of the many-faceted areas of governmental activity. When we come back from the break, we'll talk more about that, you know, governmental agency, now the Weather Service, in the case of the lobster fishermen, and see where that goes. Yeah.
With regard to the example about the government agency,
mm-hmm.
would they not be the, I mean, I know that the exception is the police officers and, I guess, the egregious activities would be, you know, liable, but wouldn't the organization as a whole fall under the government agency?
Well, see, it could be a discretionary function.
Right.
That's an additional, but see, that's where we talk in Brown versus U.S. They're two different kinds of issues. One issue is whether this is a discretionary function. The other is whether they owe a duty at all. And their argument is, I don't owe a duty to these people. Before we get to the discretionary function exemption, I may owe a duty, but still be covered by the discretionary exemption. Or I may successfully argue there's nothing about this situation that imposed on me a duty of care.
Even though their purpose indeed is to protect and serve.
Right, exactly. Even though that's the case, the law is, unless there is this sort of special relationship, or, as we see in Brown, there's some kind of justifiable reliance. So the police department's goal is to protect and serve. But if I call up Crime Check and say, hey, there's this guy that was jumping through the bushes, you know, I saw him, you know, prowling outside my window, and I went over and I turned on the light and he ran away and jumped over the fence, I want you to send your cruisers out, you know, and find this guy and put him in jail. Well, the police says, thanks for the information. They noted in their logbook. 2 weeks later, the guy's back. He's not only looking through my window, he jumps through my window, strangles me, rapes me, whatever it is he does. And I say, hey, you guys are to protect and serve. I told you about this guy. Why didn't you put him in jail? And their answer is, you know, we're doing the best we can. Now, again, the case gets better for the plaintiff where you identify a specific individual. And you say, you sort of give them a very, very identifiable task, and where they in some way commit to it, mm-hmm. where they induce in you justifiable
the confidence
reliance.
That you're...
Yes. Then you have, again, it's almost a sort of, this is why it's the end of part three, it's almost a contractual relationship. It's a deal.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't be in this except, you know, the police department can stay away from any liability if they never promise anything. But once they promise something, they can't say, well, on second thought, we don't want to be held liable. And that's part of the question of Brown versus, did they ever promise anything in Brown? Right.
Is it the...
It's a difficult question. I would say, I mean, part of what we had in Dickens versus Per Year is you may have two separate claims. There's this assault and battery, but there's this sort of outrage. Where you have the same act with different theories, the courts will use this idea of a gravamen of the claim. So you negligently install my sprinkler system, which I'm a farmer and it damages my crops. Is this a contract action? Because I signed up, we signed a contract with a whole, you know, in triplicate. Or is it a tort action for negligently damaging my crops? If we're talking about, since it's the same action, we have to decide, is it a contract or a tort? Is it a 6-year statute of limitations, 3-year statute of limitations? Then the court will say, well, what basically is this all about? Is it a breach of contract? But where you have two different acts, he hits me over the head, then he tells me, if you ever come back to North Carolina, we'll kill you. Those are two different acts, and this may fall, but this one survives.
But then what if it's like not that you have to, it's like if you have, well,
yeah.
Like seven other things.
Well, Well, again, for purposes of scheduling the patients, you may have a situation where, to the extent it's an assault and battery claim, it's gone. But to the extent it's just a negligence claim, it's still timely. And so what the plaintiff is saying, this is really a negligence claim. And the defendant is saying, no, this is really an assault and battery claim. And what I would say is, if you can separate different acts, they'll provide different statutes of limitations. But if it's a single act, the court will give it one label.
Got it.
Is there any way I can get another short sleeve?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, I've got one. I've got one in my in the library. I mean, it's like a little room in the library.
Okay.
Where it was. So
can I borrow it for days, 2 days at a time?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. In fact, do you have a laptop?
Yeah.
If you have a laptop, the thing to do is just download the whole thing.
And you can take out all the decorations?
Yeah, copy the whole thing to a...
And I can use anyone else's name?
Yeah. In fact, that would be the easiest thing, just while you're sitting in class here, just, you know how to copy the whole... Copy the whole thing, and then when you click on individual parts of it, it should...
Access everything?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
It should work.
Does the quality test testify to all three defects, or just design?
The way the restatement explains it, the consumer expectations test applies to the manufacturing defects and risk utility applies to the others. To design and warning.
Okay.
Because again, with respect to manufacturing, we don't really need a test. The test is it out of spec? And it's only in design and warning that we really need a test. And it's at that point that I think the preference is to use that's because we know what that means.
Consumer expectation test.
Well, look at the way it's built in the document statute. It says, in applying these other things, you should consider the consumer's reasonable expectations. Well, how does that relate to, I mean, there's no priority. First you do this, then you do that, or this one's more important than that one, or they're both. You know, there's absolutely no explanations to how all this
was here together.
Yeah.
You don't want to get your gas mileage or not die. Kind of thing.
Right. And the question is, what is the reasonable? I agree with the restatement commentary that says, as applied to design questions, the consumer expectation test is virtually meaningless. What does a reasonable consumer expect of a Volkswagen bus? You can't answer that question. You can answer the risk utility question because you can talk to engineers, and they'll tell you what it costs to eliminate this danger and so
forth.
Yeah, you are. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Right, just like that. Right. Yeah. I'll attach that to the end of the agreement.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got a case for
that. Basically, that's
what they argue. There is the courts are completely sealed. Because they're, on the one hand, it's not a policy-making function. At the same time, they want to provide them with limited good faith immunity. But the law is really a mess in this area because the courts are. I actually give an example of just our case where the court went back and forth and back and forth in the same case and couldn't make up their mind. Again, it's right at the heart of the policy question, which is, do we want to pay for all the mistakes that CPS makes? No. Do we want CPS to be immune from their stupidity? No. We want some sort of balancing casting of all the
mistakes.
Yeah, I don't know. If I were the defendant, I'd certainly argue a discretionary function. I'd certainly argue there was no duty of care, but the court may impose it, they may not. That's again why Brown v. U.S.
is maybe just responsible for Supreme Court.
Yeah, again, to recognize, I don't know how this would turn out. I know the defendant would make a strong pitch over here. I know the plaintiff would make a strong pitch over here.
Okay. what's going to happen.
I would say the special relationship is a little bit about the
Yeah.